This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of vertebral artery injury from the spine section on orthobullets.com. The incidence of vertebral artery injury is 0.5% of all trauma patients. 70% of vertebral artery injury in blunt trauma has an associated cervical fracture. Remember that vertebral artery injury is seen in 33% to 39% of all cervical spine fractures. Vertebral artery injury is also seen in 0.3% of anterior cervical spine surgery and 4.1 to 8.2% of posterior cervical spine surgery, that is specifically with C1, C2 transarticular screws. Moving on to etiology, the pathophysiology of vertebral artery injury can be secondary to blunt traumatic injury or iatrogenic injury during elective surgery. So as far as the pathoanatomy of blunt traumatic injury, the highest injury risk is at the point of entry into the C6 transverse foramen, and the second highest risk is at the C1, C2 articulation. As far as iatrogenic injury during elective surgery, it's important to talk about the safe zone. So at C1, be sure to avoid dissection cephalad to the C1 posterior arch greater than 1.5 centimeters lateral to the midline. Keep in mind that the C1 lateral mass screw should be placed in a 10 degrees medial and 22 degrees cephalad trajectory. Now let's go over some relevant anatomy. We'll go over the four arterial segments and anomalous anatomy. So the four arterial segments includes V1, V2, V3, and V4. V1 is extraosseous, and the origin is at the subclavian artery anterior to the C7 transverse process to the entry point of the C6 transverse foramen. Moving on to V2, this is found within the transverse foramina of C6 to C1. Keep in mind that the most traumatic injuries occur here. There is a high risk during drilling, tapping, and insertion of lateral mass or pedicle screws. Moving on to V3, this is seen at the superior aspect of the arch of the atlas to the foramen magnum. The vertebral artery is vulnerable during lateral exposure and laminectomy of C1. There's also high risk of vertebral artery injury when there are C1, C2 transarticular screws directed caudally and laterally. Finally, V4 has intradural extension from the foramen magnum to unite with the contralateral vertebral artery, and this forms the basilar artery. Keep in mind that most injuries from cervical trauma are seen in V2, or the foraminal segment. Now, in terms of anomalous anatomy, there's a reported prevalence of 2.7% in anterior cervical surgery. Specifically, the transverse foramen may be medial to or within 1.5 millimeters of the oncovertebral joint. There's also a reported prevalence of 2.3 to 20% in the atlantoaxial region, specifically a high-riding C2 foramen, C2 pedicle erosion, and C2 lateral mass thinning. Now, let's go over the classification of vertebral artery injury. And the one to know is the Biffle Vertebral Artery Injury Grading System, which is divided into 5 grades. Grade 1 corresponds to arteriographic appearance of vessel dissection / intramural hematoma with less than 25% luminal stenosis. Grade 2 corresponds to intraluminal thrombosis or raised intimal flap. There will also be a dissection / intramural hematoma with greater than 25% luminal stenosis. Grade 3 corresponds to a pseudoaneurysm, grade 4 corresponds to vessel occlusion, and grade 5 corresponds to vessel transection. As far as presentation of vertebral artery injury, the history consists of recent cervical spine trauma, like a C1 or C2 fracture, or subaxial facet fractures and dislocations. The history may also consist of recent elective surgery of the cervical spine or craniocervical junction. Symptoms of vertebral artery injury can be variable in presentation and time of onset. Vertebrobasilar insufficiency manifests with dizziness, vertigo, nausea, diplopia, blindness, ataxia, bilateral weakness, and oropharyngeal dysfunction. Moving on to imaging, as far as radiographs, x-rays of certain fracture patterns raise suspicion for vertebral artery injury. CT angiography, or CTA, is used for identification of local occlusion or extravasation. The sensitivity is reported at 100%. Now let's go over some CTA indications for the trauma patient where any single criteria is an indication. These include unexplained central or lateralizing neurologic deficit, evidence of acute cerebral infarct on CT scan of the head, a GCS of less than 9, evidence of diffuse axonal injury, facial fracture or Lafort type 2 or 3 fracture, cervical spine fracture or subluxation, which can include a C1, C2, or C3 fracture, fracture extension into the transverse foramen, and keep in mind that vertebral artery injury is demonstrated in 20% of cases with cervical spine fracture or subluxation. Other indications for obtaining a CTA include cervical spinal cord injury, hanging injuries, as well as major thoracic injury or first rib fractures. magnetic resonance angiography, or MRA, can be used for identification of local occlusion / stenosis. The sensitivity is 93.9%. Indications include cervical spine fractures with neurologic deficits attributable to damaged vertebral or basilar artery perfusion. Now, let's talk about the treatment of vertebral artery injury, starting with postoperative anticoagulation, where the goal is to prevent thromboembolic sequela of injury. Modalities include intravenous heparin and acetyl salicylic acid, or aspirin. This is indicated as the first line of treatment. Other modalities include clopidogrel, IV thrombolysis, and glycoprotein 2B/3A antagonists, such as abciximab, eptifibatide, and tirofiban. Contraindications to postoperative anticoagulation includes major intracranial infarction and intraspinal hematoma/arteriovenous fistula. Other treatment options include operative reduction and stabilization as necessitated by fracture pattern, certain surgical techniques to control hemorrhage, which we'll talk about in a moment, immediate intraoperative angiography, which can assist with intraoperative decision-making, and in terms of postoperative management following iatrogenic injury, observation is the first line, where further intervention is dictated by the clinical course. Immediate postoperative angiography can detect vascular complications, confirms adequate collateral cerebral circulation, and allows embolization of fistula or pseudoaneurysm. Now, let's talk about some of these management techniques in a bit more detail. Specifically, we'll go over hemostatic tamponade, microvascular repair, direct ligation, and IR-guided embolization. With respect to hemostatic tamponade, this involves utilization of topical hemostatic agents and bone wax. If the vertebral artery is injured during C1-C2 transarticular screw placement, you can actually tamponade by screw insertion. However, risks include delayed hemorrhage and fistula formation. Microvascular repair allows restoration of normal blood flow and minimizes risk of ischemic complications. However, this is of course technically demanding. With respect to direct ligation, consider intraoperative angiography first to evaluate collateral circulation. However, keep in mind that this risks certain morbidities, for example, cerebellar infarction, where you will have loss of flow via the posterior inferior cerebellar artery, or PICA, isolated cranial nerve paresis, and hemiplegia. Another potential treatment option for vertebral artery injury is IR-guided embolization. As far as complications may occur days to years following injury. These can include arteriovenous fistula, late-onset hemorrhage, pseudoaneurysm, which may be a delayed presentation, thrombosis with embolic incidence, cerebral ischemia / stroke with persistent vertigo, and death. Now, let's end this review session talking about the prognosis of vertebral artery injury. Keep in mind that the impact of vertebral artery injury is difficult to predict. Many patients initially are asymptomatic, however, some progress to cerebral ischemia or stroke with permanent neurologic deficit. Finally, it's important to note that vertebral artery injury will manifest with variable symptomatology in different patients. Okay, so now that we've gone over the major points about this topic, let's go over a few questions to apply the information and get a sense of how this topic might be tested. First question. During a C1-C2 posterior spinal fusion, while performing the dissection of posterior arch of C1 and pedicle of C2, the surgeon encounters rapid pulsatile arterial bleeding. The artery is tamponaded off, vascular surgery is consulted, and an intraoperative angiogram is performed. Given adequate collateral flow, the injured artery is embolized. Postoperatively, the patient's neurologic function is normal. Injury to this arterial structure could have best been avoided by minimizing dissection in which of the following areas? And the choices are 1. Dorsolaterally along the C1-C2 facet, medial to the foramen transversarium. 2. Ventral along the medial border of the pars of C2. 3. Cephalad to the posterior arch of C1 when greater than 1.5 centimeters lateral to the midline. 4. Caudal to the posterior arch of C1 when less than 1 centimeter lateral to the midline. And 5. Cephalad to the posterior arch of C1 when less than 1 centimeter lateral to the midline. The correct answer to this question is 3. Cephalad to the posterior arch of C1 when greater than 1.5 centimeters lateral to the midline. So the clinical presentation is consistent with an intraoperative injury to the vertebral artery in the upper posterior cervical spine. Avoiding dissection more than 1.5 centimeters lateral to the midline and dissecting subperiosteally on the inferior aspect of the posterior arch of C1 can help avoid injury to the vertebral artery. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, dorsolaterally along the C1-C2 facet, medial to the foramen transversarium, and answer 2, ventral along the medial border of the pars of C2 are both incorrect, as dissection dorsolaterally along the pars of C2 and C1-C2 facet risks injury to the C2 nerve root, which is encountered medial and prior to the vertebral artery traveling between the C2 and C1 foramen transverse area. Some surgeons advocate for routine sacrifice of the C2 nerve root during C1 screw placement. Answer 4, caudal to the posterior arch of C1 when less than 1 centimeter lateral to the midline is incorrect, as dissection ventrally past the posterior arch of C1 risks injury to the dura and spinal cord. Finally, answer 5, cephalad to the posterior arch of C1 when less than 1 centimeter lateral to the midline is incorrect, as the tectorial membrane is an anterior structure and cranial continuation of the posterior longitudinal ligament. Reaching this structure from a posterior approach would require dissection past the spinal cord. To quickly review, the vertebral artery most commonly courses cranially through the foramen transverse area of C2 and C1, after which it courses medially along the superior aspect of the C1 arch until turning cranially into the foramen magnum. While anatomic variations are common, dissection greater than 1.5 centimeters lateral to the midline and along the posterior arch of C1 puts the vertebral artery at the greatest risk of injury. This risk can be mitigated by preoperative imaging, evaluating for any anatomic variation combined with technical consideration for the course of the artery during exposure and instrumentation. Hu et al. Performed an anatomic study using fine-cut CT scans to determine the optimal entry point and trajectory for C1 lateral mass screws in order to minimize risk to the vertebral artery and surrounding structures. The authors reported a safe starting height of 4.3 millimeters, 27.6 millimeters lateral to the mid-sagittal axis, and angle 20 degrees medially. Molinari et al. Reviewed the literature on vertebral artery injury during posterior cervical exposure. The authors noted the high incidence of vertebral artery anomalies in the upper cervical spine and the coincidence of vertebral artery injuries with aberrant anatomy in the C1-C2 interval. Putkar et al. Evaluated C1 lateral mass and C2 pedicle screw placement in 49 cases of posterior C1-C2 fusion. The authors noted that an entry point for the C2 pedicle located 3 millimeters below the midpoint of the C1-C2 joint and directed caudally and medially into the body of C2 best avoided injury to the vertebral artery. Moving on to the next question. During the posterior exposure of the atlas arch in the cervical spine, excessive retraction of greater than 2 centimeters past midline would cause injury to an anatomical structure. Which of the following statements is true about this structure? And the choices are 1, injury to this structure causes postoperative hoarseness. 2, the structure is a branch of the vagus nerve. 3, injury to this structure causes weakness in forearm supination. 4, the structure typically originates from the subclavian artery and travels cephalad through the transverse foramen. And 5, the structure is a terminal branch of the common carotid artery. The correct answer to this question is 4, the structure typically originates from the subclavian artery and travels cephalad through the transverse foramen. So the vertebral artery is at significant risk of injury during posterior atlas arch exposure greater than 2 centimeters beyond the midline. The vertebral artery classically originates from the subclavian artery and travels through the transverse foramen in the majority of patients. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, injury to this structure causes postoperative hoarseness, and answer 2, the structure is a branch of the vagus nerve, are both incorrect, as injury to the recurrent laryngeal nerve, which is a branch of the vagus nerve and is more common in anterior cervical procedures, would result in postoperative hoarseness. Answer 3, injury to this structure causes weakness in forearm supination is incorrect, as injury to the C5 nerve root would result in a C5 palsy. This is not the most likely injured structure, with excessive lateral exposure of the atlas posterior arch. Finally, answer 5, the structure is a terminal branch of the common carotid artery is incorrect, as the internal carotid artery, or ICA, is the terminal branch of the common carotid artery. In the posterior cervical approach, the ICA is a deeper structure and would be at high risk of injury with bicortical fixation of C1 lateral mass or C1-C2 transarticular instrumentation. And moving on to the final question, the right vertebral artery sustains a complex injury during an occipital cervical or C3 to occiput fusion. Bleeding cannot be controlled with local tamponade and a hemostatic agent. After clamping the vessel, a segmental defect is noted in the vessel. The patient undergoes urgent angiography, which reveals adequate collateral circulation. What is the next step in the management of this injury? And the choices are 1, addition of a systemic antifibrillitic solution. 2, direct repair. 3, contralateral vertebral artery anastomosis. 4, acute synthetic grafting. And 5, embolization treatment. The correct answer to this question is 5, embolization treatment. So when one, vertebral artery bleeding cannot be controlled with local tamponade and a local hemostatic agent, and two, collateral circulation is maintained in the non-dominant artery, where keep in mind the left vertebral artery is usually dominant, the next best step would be to achieve local control with an intraoperative endovascular procedure such as embolization, stenting, or clipping. To quickly go over the incorrect answers, answer 1, addition of a systemic antifibrillitic solution is incorrect, as the addition of a systemic antifibrillitic solution such as tranexamic acid would not control large vessel bleeding after injury and achieve long-term hemostasis. Answer 2, direct repair is incorrect, as the technical demands of the exposure and microvascular repair of a complex vertebral artery in the setting of uncontrolled bleeding would be too difficult, especially when it involves the non-dominant artery and collateral circulation is maintained. Answer 3, contralateral vertebral artery anastomosis is incorrect, as again, the technical demands of the exposure and microvascular anastomosis in the setting of uncontrolled bleeding would be too difficult. Finally, answer 4, acute synthetic grafting is incorrect, as vertebral artery stent graft may be considered in chronic situations such as symptomatic vertebrojugular arteriovenous fistula. This would not be the first-line treatment in the setting of uncontrolled bleeding. To quickly review, the management of vertebral artery injury is difficult. If local tamponade can be achieved, the next best step would be to consider direct repair of the artery. If tamponade fails to achieve proper hemostasis, additional procedures may be considered, such as intraoperative endovascular embolization or clipping and ligation. When considering these intraoperative endovascular treatments, the collateral circulation should be assessed. If collateral circulation is inadequate, direct repair or stenting should be reconsidered. Peng et al. Reviewed the anatomical considerations, management, and preventative measures of vertebral artery injury in cervical spine surgery. They showed that ligation-associated morbidities such as cerebellar infarction, cranial nerve palsies, or hemiplegia can occur in up to 12% of cases. They suggest direct repair should be considered as first-line treatment when local hemostasis can be controlled. Lal et al. Reviewed the perioperative complications associated with occipitocervical fusion. The most commonly encountered complications were related to instrumentation failure after non-union at 6-7%. Other complications included vertebral artery injury, dural tears, and wound infections. With respect to vertebral artery injury, keep in mind that 1.3% to 4.1% occurred during placement of C1-C2 transarticular screws, most commonly in the case of a high-riding vertebral artery. That's all for this review about vertebral artery injury. Hopefully that was helpful. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. Keep in mind that these podcasts are designed to go along with the topics on orthobullets.com, and in fact, you can listen to these episodes right on the OrthoBullets website or mobile app while going through the topic. If you've gotten any value from the OrthoBullets podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Also, if you aren't already, be sure to follow OrthoBullets on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for daily high-yield content. Thanks for tuning in. We'll see you all tomorrow right here on the OrthoBullets podcast.